Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 9, Chapter 11. Prince Andrew's eyes were still following Fuel out of the room when Count Bennigsen entered hurriedly, and nodding to Bolkonski but not pausing, went into the study, giving instructions to his adjutant as he went. The Emperor was following him, and Bennigsen had hastened on to make some preparations and to be ready to receive the sovereign. Chernyshev and Prince Andrew went out into the porch, where the Emperor, who looked fatigued, was dismounting. Marquis Paulucci was talking to him with a particular warmth, and the Emperor, with his head bent to the left, was listening with a dissatisfied air. The Emperor moved forward, evidently wishing to end the conversation, but the flushed and excited Italian, oblivious of decorum, followed him and continued to speak. "And as for the man who advised forming this camp, the Drissa camp," said Paulucci, as the Emperor mounted the steps and, noticing Prince Andrew, scanned his unfamiliar face. "As to that person, sire," continued Paulucci desperately, apparently unable to restrain himself, "the man who advises the Drissa camp, I see no alternative but the lunatic asylum or the gallows." Without heeding the end of the Italian's remarks, and as though not hearing them, the Emperor, recognizing Bolkonski, addressed him graciously. "I'm very glad to see you. Go in there where they are meeting and wait for me." The Emperor went into the study. He was followed by Prince Peter Mikhailovich Bolkonski and Baron Stein, and the door closed behind him. Prince Andrew, taking advantage of the Emperor's permission, accompanied Paulucci, whom he had known in the Turkey, into the drawing room where the council was assembled. Prince Peter Mikhailovich Bolkonski occupied the position, as it were, of chief of the Emperor's staff. He came out of the study into the drawing room with some maps, which he spread on a table, and put questions on which he wished to hear the opinion of the gentlemen present. What had happened was that news, which afterwards proved to be false, had been received during the night of a movement by the French to outflank the Drissa camp. The first to speak was the general, Armfelt, who, to meet the difficulty that presented itself, unexpectedly proposed a perfectly new position away from the Petersburg and Moscow roads. The reason for this was inexplicable, unless he wished to show that he, too, could have an opinion, but he urged that at this point the army should unite and there await the enemy. It was plain that Armfelt had thought out the plan long ago and now expounded it not so much to answer the questions put, which in fact his plan did not answer, as to avail himself of the opportunity to air it. It was one of the millions of proposals, one as good as another, that could be made as long as it was quite unknown what character the war would take. Some disputed his arguments, others defended them. Young Count Toll objected to the Swedish general's views more warmly than anyone else, and in the course of the dispute drew from his side pocket a well-filled notebook which he asked permission to read to them. In these voluminous notes, Toll suggested another scheme totally different from Armfelt's or Fuel's plan of campaign. In answer to Toll, Paulucci suggested an advance and an attack which he urged could alone extricate us from the present uncertainty and from the trap, as he called the Drissa camp, in which we were situated. During all these discussions, Fuel and his interpreter Wolzogen, his bridge in court relations, were silent. Fuel only snorted contemptuously and turned away to show that he would never demean himself by replying to such nonsense as he was now hearing. So when Prince Bolkonski, who was in the chair, called on him to give his opinion, he merely said, "Why ask me? General Armfelt has proposed a splendid position with an exposed rear, and why not this Italian gentleman's attack? Very fine. Or retreat, also good. Why ask me?" said he. "Why, you yourselves know everything better than I do." But when Bolkonski said with a frown that it was in the Emperor's name that he asked his opinion, Fuel rose and suddenly, growing animated, began to speak. Everything has been spoilt, everything muddled, everybody thought they knew better than I did, and now you come to me. How mend matters? There is nothing to mend. The principles laid down by me must be strictly adhered to, said he, drumming on the table with his bony fingers. What is the difficulty? Nonsense, childishness. He went up to the map and, speaking rapidly, began proving that no eventuality could alter the efficiency of the Drissa camp, that everything had been foreseen, and that if the enemy were really going to outflank it, the enemy would inevitably be destroyed. Pulucci, who did not know German, began questioning him in French. Walsingham came to the assistance of his chief, who spoke French badly, and began translating for him, hardly able to keep pace with Fuel, who was rapidly demonstrating that not only all that had happened, but all that could happen, had been foreseen in his scheme, and that if there were now any difficulties, that whole fault lay in the fact that his plan had not been precisely executed. He kept laughing sarcastically. He demonstrated, and at last contemptuously ceased to demonstrate, like a mathematician who ceases to prove in various ways the accuracy of a problem that has already been proven. Walsingham took his place and continued to explain his views in French, every now and then turning to Fuel and saying, "Is it not so, Your Excellency?" But Fuel, like a man heated in a fight who strikes those on his own side, shouted angrily at his supporter, Walsingham, "Well, of course, what more is there to explain?" Pulucci and Mitchord both attacked Walsingham simultaneously in French. Armfelt addressed Fuel in German. Toll explained to Volkonsky in Russian, and Prince Andrew listened and observed in silence. Of all these men, Prince Andrew sympathized most with Fuel, angry, determined, and absurdly self-confident as he was. Of all those present, evidently he alone was not seeking anything for himself, nursed no hatred against anyone, and only desired that the plan, formed on a theory arrived at by years of toil, should be carried out. He was ridiculous and unpleasantly sarcastic, but yet he inspired involuntarily respect by his boundless devotion to an idea. Besides this, the remarks of all except Fuel had one common trait that had not been noticeable at the Council of War in 1805. There was now a panic fear of Napoleon's genius, which, though concealed, was noticeable in every rejoinder. Everything was assumed to be possible for Napoleon. They expected him at every side, and invoked his terrible name to shatter each other's proposals. Fuel alone seemed to consider Napoleon a barbarian like everyone else, who opposed his theory. But besides this feeling of respect, Fuel evoked pity in Prince Andrew. From the tone in which the courtiers addressed him, and the way Pulucci had allowed himself to speak of him to the Emperor, but above all from a certain desperation in Fuel's own expressions, it was clear that the others knew, and Fuel himself felt, that his fall was at hand. And despite his self-confidence and grumpy German sarcasm, he was pitiable, with his hair smoothly brushed on the temples and sticking up in tufts behind. Though he concealed the fact under a show of irritation and contempt, he was evidently in despair that the sole remaining chance of verifying his theory by a huge experiment and proving its soundness to the whole world was slipping away from him. The discussions continued a long time, and the longer they lasted, the more heated became the disputes, culminating in shouts and personalities, and the less was it possible to arrive at any general conclusion from all that had been said. Prince Andrew, listening to this polyglot talk and to these surmises, plans, refutations, and shouts, felt nothing but amazement at what they were saying. A thought that had long since and often occurred to him during his military activities, the idea that there is not and cannot be any science of war, and that therefore there can be no such thing as a military genius, now appeared to him an obvious truth. What theory and science is possible about a matter, the conditions and circumstances of which are unknown and cannot be defined, especially when the strength of the acting forces cannot be ascertained? No one was or is able to foresee in what condition our or the enemy's armies will be in a day's time, and no one can gauge the force of this or that detachment. Sometimes, when there is not a coward at the front to shout, "We are cut off," and start running, but a brave and jolly lad who shouts, "Hurrah!" a detachment of 5,000 is worth 30,000, as at Schön Grabern, while at times 50,000 run from 8,000, as at Austerlitz. What science can there be in a matter in which, as in all practical matters, nothing can be defined, and everything depends on innumerable conditions, the significance of which is determined at a particular moment which arrives no one knows when? Armfelt says our army is cut in half, and Pellucci says we have got the French army between two fires. Bichord says that the worthlessness of the Drissa camp lies in having the river behind it, and Fuel says that it is what constitutes its strength. Toll proposes one plan, Armfelt another, and they are all good and all bad, and the advantages of any suggestion can only be seen at the moment of trial. And why do they all speak of a military genius? Is a man a genius who can order bread to be brought up at the right time and say who is to go to the right and who to the left? Is it only because military men are invested with pomp and power, and cowards of sycophants flatter power, attributing to it qualities of genius it does not possess? The best generals I have known were, on the contrary, stupid or absent-minded men. Bagration was the best, Napoleon himself admitted that, and Bonaparte himself. I remember his limited, self-satisfied face on the field of Austerlitz. Not only does a good army commander not need any special qualities, on the contrary, he needs the absence of the highest and best human attributes, love, poetry, tenderness, and philosophic inquiring doubt. He should be limited, firmly convinced that what he is doing is very important, otherwise he will not have sufficient patience. And only then will he be a brave leader. God forbid that he should be humane, should love or pity or think of what is just and unjust. It is understandable that a theory of their genius was invented for them long ago because they have power. The success of a military action depends not on them, but on the man in the ranks who shouts, "We are lost," or who shouts, "Hurrah!" And only in the ranks can one serve with assurance of being useful. So thought Prince Andrew as he listened to the talking, and he roused himself only when Pellucci called him and everyone was leaving. At the review next day, the Emperor asked Prince Andrew where he would like to serve, and Prince Andrew lost his standing in court circles forever by not asking to remain attached to the sovereign's person, but for permission to serve in the army. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. And, well, I like this Fuel character, although he seems to be being weeded out. No one seems to be on board with his military strategy. But this chapter was really about, I think it was really about that last paragraph, that last sentence even. André listened to everybody argue and put in their pitches for, you know, they're pitching their ideas about what they think the strategy should be, who's a genius, who's got the genius plan, and Prince André is listening and thinking, you know what, there's no such thing as a military genius because it's an impossible task to figure out what's the best course of action. He kind of has the epiphany that a military strategist, the genius of winning a war doesn't really lie with them. It lies with the leader, the good leader who's on the ground leading the troops in the moment. And it all culminates in that last sentence where the Emperor himself asks André where he would like to serve during the war. He's more or less at that point put on a silver platter whatever promotion André says he wants, and his integrity kicks in, and he's just had the realization that wars aren't won by the high up strategists, they're won by the leaders on the ground, and he says to the Emperor that he wants to be in the army serving on the ground, and lost his place in the courts forever. You know, I'm sure there's a little bit of both. I'm sure that strategies, scientific strategies of war, do work to some degree. And you can see that. I mean, you can see it in modern warfare especially. But also, what's definitely true is that motivated and confident troops with a good leader will fight 10 times better than dejected ones who are lost and they don't have confidence in their actions. And that's where that sentence about having someone at the front yelling hurrah can make 10 to 1 odds swing in your favor. Or if that person at the front says, you know, everything's over, we've lost, then the opposite can be true, and 50,000 men can be outdone by 5,000 men. Reddit user Chattel Valster said, Andre is of the opinion that there can't be any military science because in war nothing can be determined. Everything depends on the man in the ranks who shouts hurrah or we've lost. Do you agree with him, and do you think that joining the army is the best way to make sure someone will shout hurrah? Or do you think there's a better way which influences more people to shout hurrah? Well, that's a really good question. I think he's come to the conclusion that you have to be in the army, in with the troops, leading them in order to get them to yell hurrah. You have to lead by example. But then there was that little camp in that chapter where it was like lists of different people, different camps. I think it was like 8 different opinions detailed out, and one of them was the people who worship the emperor to such a degree that they become almost frenzied or ecstatic just about his presence, that the presence of their emperor will motivate them to do crazy things, like how those troops ran into the river and drowned themselves to show how keen they were to cross the river because Napoleon was standing there watching. That kind of leader doesn't really have to do much, but he is damn sure getting everyone to say hurrah on a much broader scale than someone who's leading down with the troops. I think it was it Nikolai who had that kind of fervor, that madness when he saw the emperor, and he was so motivated and did all this crazy stuff. He was absolutely obsessed with the man. Too Clever by 8715 said, Tolstoy's characterization of the previous wars leads me to believe that Andre is right about the man who shouts hurrah, or we've lost. Perhaps he's going back to the army to try to be that guy, and getting away from these stupid generals is just a bonus. I don't think his motivation is to get away from these people. I think he's had another one of his patented Andre epiphanies. I'm surprised he wasn't staring at a branch or a twig or something like that, or a cloud in the sky, and he's realized that his place in the war is on the ground, motivating the troops as a leader by example. That's what he wants to do, and he wants to strategize, but he wants to do it from within the war, not from outside it at a cushy post. He wants to get his hands dirty. I suppose from a narrative perspective, it's a good choice. I mean, this is a book about war and peace, and Andre's one of the main characters. So for him to dive back headfirst into the war in an effort to escape his demons of his personal life, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? You know, I didn't want him to jump back into war. I wanted him to have a happy life and sort out his stuff and get married to Natasha and be an awesome power couple and all that. But I suppose that's not really what this book's about. So from a narrative perspective, from the perspective of another writer and a storyteller, when I see Tolstoy make that twist and turn, I think, yeah, fair enough. Like, that's what's going to be a more interesting story. There's more juice in that story. So off to war he goes yet again. And that certainly will keep him distracted from his heartbreak that he's trying to ignore. Anyway, we're going to leave this chapter there. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.